This is an oral history interview on the 10th of January with Hal Sargenti. The interviewer is Arnold Thackray. Hal, can we begin with the things that have happened in the business world from the moment that you were exiting Freedom?
When I left Freedom in 1998, the company, a decision had been made to sell the company, and basically the reason for that was that the investors, which was the Joseph Little John Levy Fund, didn't have any additional funds in their fund to invest to grow the company. So there was no need for two very senior people for a company the size of Freedom, myself and Fred Rulo, and I was mainly doing acquisitions, although participating in the operations as well. And so I left, keeping my seat on the board and actively involved in helping in the company where I could, and went out and started to look at doing acquisitions on my own, and repeating the Freedom experience. At that time, I considered the possibility of trying to raise an investment fund of my own, and I talked to all of the experts, and they all told me that that would be very difficult to do. It would take over 18 months, and so forth. And that there was plenty of money available for investment, and so we decided, instead of trying to raise a fund for investment specifically for the chemical industry, that we go ahead and find acquisitions, bring those opportunities to funds that existed, and as I look backwards, that probably was the biggest single mistake I made.
What would raising a fund of one's own meant? I mean, how would that have?
Well, you would have to define what the purpose of the fund was. You'd have to visit with, for instance, pension funds and other state funds and so forth. People who have billions of dollars to invest. And most of its money comes from people like Calipers, the California pension funds, the state of Pennsylvania. These people have 50, 80, 100 billion dollars under management and are always looking for a place to put it. And they put it into these leveraged buyout funds. So one would have to make the rounds and raise the money or obtain the commitments from various pension funds and investors to support your activity. That actually is a very lucrative business because the people who have a fund get a what we call a carried interest in their investments, and they also get fees for managing the funds. And so, and they have control over whether the investments are done or not. And so, at the time, and at my age level, I didn't want to take the 2 years that the experts told us that it would take to raise the money.
Which would be to set up as a venture capitalist in your own right.
As an LBO fund. I remember at that time I talked with Gordon Cain as well, and he had never raised a fund of his own, and he thought again that there was a lot of money out there and you didn't need a fund of your own. But what I concluded after all of these years is that the control over whether the investment is made or not, and the risk tolerance of the people making the investment and the knowledge are all factors, and you don't have control of that when you don't have your own fund. As an example, we had a relationship with, we established, instead of ourselves, working with Liberty Partners. In New York, Liberty Partners got their money from the state of Florida pension fund and had, you know, $1 billion to invest. And so they were going to support our equity needs, the amount of the money that we had to put up when we bought a business. Together we made a run at a company called Fomex, which is a very large company. The controlling shareholder was in personal bankruptcy, so it was a very difficult transaction, and we made a bid for it, we lined up other people to participate with Liberty. And to make a long story short, we never completed that transaction, and there were a variety of reasons for that, but basically we were different between ourselves and the company by about $1 a share, which was $25 million. There were only 25 million shares outstanding. $1 a share on a transaction that had a total value of $1 billion or more. And I'm saying, as far as we were concerned, I was concerned personally, I would have done that transaction. One, because we knew the business, we knew the industry, we knew there was a tremendous amount of potential for improvement, and we would have paid that additional money. But we didn't control that decision. The people putting the equity in did, and for a variety of reasons, they decided not to do that. There are many, many other examples of that, and so on. These last few years, 4 years, that it's been since we sold Freedom, there have been many, many times when we had transactions that we would have completed that we didn't complete. To make a long story short, we did do one transaction after Freedom was sold, and that was a transaction with DLJ, where we bought the small company we continued to own and operate in France, called SODES. It was a small transaction.
How do you spell that?
SODES, and it stands for the Society de Synthetic Alcohol, or something like that. We have a website, but it's the French name. SODES is an abbreviation of the French name. And so, to make a long story short, the idea was that we would build a company around that, and we made the acquisition. It's a small French company. It's very profitable now. It's been very profitable over the 5 years, except for about a 15-month period where crude oil prices went up and escalated. We had another acquisition to follow on that, and it was an acquisition of a company called Halterman. It was an acquisition that we brought to DLJ because we had an intimate relationship with the private owner.
This is a German.
A German company. Mr. Halterman had been a customer of Arco's. We had a very strong relationship with him. And he was in his 80s, wanted to sell his company. We had an exclusive to purchase it. And we got down to the fact that we were within $10 million of buying the company. And we differed in price on $10 million. And we also had an exclusive that ran out in a certain period of time. He was more concerned about completing the transaction because he had two elderly sisters who were shareholders, and he wanted the transaction for tax purposes to be done by the end of the year. So in September,
what year was that?
This was like 99. In September, he said, I want you to put up equity, some earnest money that guarantees me you'll complete the transaction by the end of the year. You've been working since the end of June, September, the end of September. And DLJ said, why? We're DLJ. We say we'll complete the transaction, we'll complete the transaction. He said, well, I know that, he said, but if you put $1 million or $2 million up, it'd make me feel better, and I won't feel like a fool to my sisters. And they said, why? We don't do that. And I said, look, guys, you know, this is a ridiculous request. It's meaningless. I'll put the money in. So, no, we don't do that. The end result of that was that our exclusive ran out September 30th. The old man that brought in an English buyer, they bid $10 million more than we did, and closed the transaction in 30 days. The sad part of that story is, as soon as that happened, why, our equity providers wanted to go in and pay more, but the old man said, I'm sorry, now I've given them an exclusive and I can't do that. It was an interesting example. The English company, by the way, added some other things to that and later sold the company to Dow. We were going to pay $100 million for it, sold the company to Dow for $440 million two or three years later. Would have been a fantastic home run. Again, one of the ones we missed. So we've had a number of those, and the point that I'm trying to make is that the guy who has the fund controls ultimately the decision. And depending upon his risk tolerance or the idiosyncrasies involved in it, you get into all kinds of variations when you don't have control. We've worked with a lot of different people, a lot of different funds, and I'm convinced that we have more risk tolerance than a lot of the people that we work with, and the reason for that is our intimate knowledge of the business. If you're not familiar with the business, it's very difficult to accept the risks that go with the business. And there are always a million questions you could ask about the business, and I'm saying no company goes through the extensive due diligence that the leveraged buyout firms do. Now, people will argue that's why they get such high returns, but they have their share of disasters as well. But I'm saying there isn't a lot of specific industry experience in these funds. And so yet they've done well and achieved very high returns.
These funds like DLJ typically are general funds. Are there any funds that are focused to the industry?
There were some funds that were put together for telecommunications and specific industries, but generally they go out and they raise money as a general fund that cuts across. And as a matter of fact, in many cases, the amount of money you can invest in any one segment is usually limited to a percentage of the fund. For instance, you might be, if you raise a $1 billion fund, that you can only invest 10% chemicals, and that kind of thing. So they're meant, for the most part, to be diverse, but there have been occasionally some targeted funds. And that was another reason people gave us why we couldn't be successful. Because we were talking about the chemical industry, and there weren't very many targeted funds, and the chemical industry wasn't an industry that people thought highly of. Yet we had the experience of having made a lot of money on our Freedom transaction, and I believe we will also have a very successful transaction when we sell our small French company. But that, I mean, we'll make four times amount of money we put in. So, I think we've looked at a lot of businesses, a lot of transactions. We've had some very unusual things happen to us. We've lost some transactions that we shouldn't have lost, but fundamentally, we have not moved forward with as many transactions as we would have liked over these last several years.
So can you see any pattern in, when you say you've lost ones, that is there any pattern in who you've lost them to, as it were?
No. You see, we look, our niche, when I say our niche, Search Engine Investment Partners, is we look for difficult transactions. Transactions that have failed, transactions that involve problems, because we feel what we bring to the table is the management expertise to solve problems. And for instance, Fomex, it was a company that was undermanaged, in our opinion. And by the way, that came to me, Sam Heyman, who was the CEO of International Specialty Products, called me and said that he was friendly with Marshall Kogan, CEO of Fomex, who was a controlling shareholder of a company and was involved in a personal bankruptcy, and they needed somebody who could handle a difficult deal, and he said he had recommended Kogan, that Kogan called me and asked me if I would take Kogan's call. Fomex had been a customer of ARCO, so I knew Fomex and I knew Kogan, although not very well. But I did go ahead and did meet with Kogan, and we did decide to go ahead and try to buy his firm. But it was a very complicated transaction. And, of course, a lot of people don't like to do that. They like simple, plain, vanilla transactions. And so the difficulty of the transaction, the bankers refer to it as a transaction that has a lot of hair on it. So the difficulty of the transaction was a problem. You never seem to get the size right.
Size?
In other words, for instance, I'll give you an example. We're working with Morgan Stanley at the moment. Morgan Stanley has a $3.5 billion fund. So when we bring them a transaction for $100 million, they say, geez, you know, it's so small, it only requires us putting up $30 or $40 million. Bring us something that uses $150 million. On the other side, you work with some people, like with Liberty, on the Fomex transaction. There was a $1 billion transaction that required putting $300 million up. It was too big for them. So you got this problem of the size of the transaction and the partner, et cetera, and bringing in multiple sources of equity, which is a problem because everybody's got a different opinion and they all are used to controlling their own situation. So it's a very complex set of reasons. We had an unfortunate experience with DLJ. They had gone off and decided that they didn't want to invest in chemicals anymore after we bought Sodus. And they were investing heavily in electronics. And they made a lot of money there, but they also wrote off over $1 billion when the collapse came. So we had gone to work with Liberty Partners. And to make a long story short, we were looking at BF Goodrich Chemical, which was a very large transaction, too large for Liberty Partners. Again, it was a transaction that required about $300 million of equity. So we approached DLJ and asked them if they would like to participate with Liberty. They went out there. They said they had looked at it, and it was too complex. And remember, Goodrich was the company we sold Freedom to. So 25% of Goodrich was the old Freedom Chemical. But they said, since we had a lot of knowledge about the company, they'd be happy to look at it with us. To make a long story short, we did look at it. We did go out and do the due diligence and have management meetings. We were prepared to put a bid in on it. When DLJ backed out and decided to go forward with another partner. Another partner was an outfit called AEA, American Enterprise Associates, which at the time that the Goodrich deal happened was being run by a young man named John Garcia. John Garcia was a former Arco Chemical employee who we had. He was a PhD chemist, very talented, who we had sent to Wharton for an MBA, and he had left ARCO to go to work in the investment banking industry, having worked with Wertheim, Schroeder, and CSFB, Credit Suisse First Boston, and now was working for AEA. AEA is an interesting outfit because it basically has the involvement of former CEOs of major companies. For instance, Ralph Landau invests with AEA. Welch's predecessor at GE, was the original Jones, and people of that character and ilk are involved in AEA. So they have this huge group of people who are from an operating background. But to make a long story short, they were bidding against us. DLJ decided to go with them. We didn't have the equity for our bid, and they outbid us anyway. So we've had a number of disappointments, and I'll give you an example as how unpredictable this business is. We just, and the other thing that you'll get a flavor of as we go through this is that you better get things in writing. I'm not used to doing business that way, where everything has to be written down. And I'll give you a number of examples of that. We had a call, for instance, from Air Products a while back, saying that they wanted to put their methylamines business together with a business with a company in Europe, UCB, and would we be willing to partner with them on that. They wanted a financial partner who would take 60% of the deal and they would take 40 or 50-50 so they could do it off balance sheet. And wanted us to do this transaction with them. We said we would and work on it with them. And we went to Germany or to Belgium together to do the due diligence. What that means from our standpoint is that we had to get somebody who wanted to provide the equity for our share of the business. Goldman Sachs, we called Goldman Sachs, and they said they'd look at it, and actually Goldman Sachs accompanied us to the review. During the course of the discussions, it became apparent that Air Products, for its 50%, wanted a lot more than we were paying UCB, which was the Belgian company selling its business. And we said we didn't believe that was financeable. But we came back to the United States and had asked Morgan Stanley to join us in the transaction. And whereupon Air Products notified us that Goldman Sachs had brought somebody else in and that our participation was no longer necessary. And we're very unhappy about that, but we just simply said, fine, we don't believe what Goldman's told you is true. As a matter of fact, we know it can't be true. But if you've made the decision to go forward and these other people are willing to give you the price you've asked, fine, so be it. We didn't close the door, we didn't holler or scream. We'll be here if the transaction doesn't work out.
They invited you in and then ushered you out, and yeah, nothing was ever on paper.
Nothing was ever on paper, except we signed a confidentiality agreement. So a number of months went by, like this happened in November or in October. And in February, I called, and there had been no transaction. And I called Air Products and said, I didn't see any announcement and so forth. They said, oh, well, things didn't go well. Those fellas that Goldman brought in, they just when we got there, they just weren't there, and which we knew. And they said, and we've broken off discussions. I said, well, in that case, you won't mind if we try to buy the business. And they said, no, that's all right. You go right ahead. So we did. And we went over with Morgan Stanley, and we did, over the next several months, sign a contract to acquire the business. The day after we announced, made the announcement that we had signed with UCB to buy the business, I got a call. I called Air Products the day before and told them, and everything was fine, it was wonderful. Well, let's look to the future and see how we can work together. But a day or two later, I got a letter saying, you're in violation of your confidentiality agreement, which says you can't pursue the transaction for 3 years. And you didn't ask us for our approval to proceed, and we're very upset about it. So, fortunately, telephone logs and emails are a wonderful thing. And so we immediately went to the telephone logs and pinpointed the phone calls that I had made to ask them if we could proceed. And the letter I had sent to UCB saying, I discussed yesterday with Air Products whether or not we could proceed with the transaction. You recall that we were there in the fall with Air Products and so forth, and referred to the Air Products person by name, and sent these off to them and said, don't understand your problem. We had this discussion, you gave me permission to proceed, and we did so. Well, they had conveniently forgotten. But they remembered once we had the documentation.
So you do need something in writing.
Yes. Yeah. So I'm saying, and we proceeded to sign that transaction, and we're waiting for it to close.
So that is one that you open for us.
Well, nonetheless, since this isn't going to be made public for a while, I can talk about this. So we're moving towards the close. I have got the bank financing ready, and the European Commission notifies the company that it's thinks there's a cartel involved in fixing prices, and they ask for a lot of documents and whatnot. Of course, that blows the bank's mind. The bank backs off. That was in early October, and we've been waiting ever since for the commission to conclude or not. I looked at the letters from the commission, and they basically had very little, if any, evidence to indicate that a cartel was in fact operating. Although you've seen recently, this is now January 2003, you've seen recently a half a dozen investigations into cartel activity in Europe. To make a long story short, we just found out yesterday, as a matter of fact, that their investigation showed that they had no basis for going forward. So there we are. At this point, the bank says, well, regardless of that, we have to start all over. And we're not going to fund its new transaction, and we have to go through this all again. It's like the perils of pooling. And I'm saying, if you had told me in September when we reached agreement to buy this business that we wouldn't have this business by now and be operating it, I would have said, you know, it's ridiculous. So we've had a string of these things that have been unpredictable. And I guess it's very much like I've always said in a corporation, when you try to do something new and innovative, it's like climbing and scaling a mountain. And there are all these people who in the company who view it as their job to protect the company from itself and to keep you from accomplishing your objective. And you go up this mountain, this hill, and they roll these big boulders down at you. And that's the way the leverage buyout business is. You know, it's just incredible. First, you have to go through the committee of the buyout, and then you've got the government and environmental, the banks, and so forth. So it's a very complicated, difficult business. And as a result of that, the number of transactions that you do is limited, and it's even more limited when you don't control exactly what you're doing. For instance, in this case, I would clearly go out and try to find another bank. On the other hand, our partner is not doing that. So it's been an exciting time. I'm saying it hasn't been as successful as I would like.